I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
What exactly is life? It's a question for the ages, and one that became a lot more complicated in 2010 when a team of scientists created the first synthetic cell. It was life born out of not other life, but of science.
The leader of that team, J. Craig Venter, sequenced the genome a decade before anyone thought it was possible. He's here with us now to recount that pioneering effort and share what genomics may have in store for the future.
His new book is called Life at the Speed of Light, From the Double Helix to the Dawn of Digital Life. And Craig, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Nice to be with you.
Well, you begin your book with three words. What is life? Do you have an answer?
Well, we're much closer to an answer than Schrödinger was in 1944 when he wrote his book called What is Life? And he approached it as a physicist, just seeing if life obeyed the laws of physical principles, which he concluded that it did. We know from the history of the last 70 years first, that DNA was the genetic material. In 1944, they thought it was proteins. We learned the structure of DNA from Watson and Crick. We learned how to interpret the genetic code and how it coded for proteins. Then in the 1970s, the first sequences. In 1995, my team sequenced the first genome of a living organism, and that was decoding all its genetic information and putting that in the computer. And 5 years after that, we did the first version of the human genome that I'm sure most of your listeners have heard about. And I call that digitizing life, where we convert the DNA code of A, C's, G's, and T's into the ones and zeros of the computer world. And now we have shown that by going the other way, we can start with the computer code and regenerate the DNA, starting with four bottles of chemicals, and build the chromosomes and then boot up new life with that synthetic DNA. And that's what we reported in 2010. And the book describes this journey for the last 70 years of the history of DNA and how we've been able to read the genetic code and how we've learned to write it. And we've learned that life is a DNA software system.
It's pretty mind-blowing when you talk about it and you describe it that way, the idea of, you know, booting up life. That's not terminology that you usually think of as sharing the same real estate. You're using computer terminology and the terminology of biology at the same time. Does this represent a watershed moment in our human history?
It could, in terms of the biological worlds and the digital worlds of the computer have been getting closer and closer together. We can't interpret the biological world without the help of massive computers, and now we can interchange the information from DNA to the computers and back again. So I think it represents a unique transition in our history because the implications of having DNA in the digital world and being able to recapitulate life from it, the implications are pretty vast.
Well, people have imagined the creation of artificial life from Frankenstein on out. You were the first to do it. What was that initial cell like? What made it life?
Well, in fact, it was a long, arduous task of our team working for years, and the book describes a lot of the pitfalls and blind alleys and how research really works and that it is hard work to get there. But it's a cell that once it was alive, it's self-replicating and has divided billions of times, making copies of itself, and metabolizes energy using sugar as its energy source like we do. But it was really a proof of principle that all this was possible, and now we're trying to design a totally unique life in the computer that will help us understand what are the absolute necessary components that distinguish life from non-life.
This is pretty heavy and heady stuff for the average person. What are some of the practical applications that could affect everybody?
Well, the first things that we're doing with it are trying to come up with a very rapid way to respond to new emerging infections. And so we've been working with BARDA and the U.S. government and the Novartis vaccine company to come up with a way using our tools to very rapidly make new flu vaccines. And we've been able to shorten the time from months down to less than 12 hours simply by taking the digital code out of the computer and rewriting new genetic code to code for the vaccine form of the virus. This has the implications that we could actually send a new vaccine around the world in less than 1 second. And so if you have one of these decoder boxes, you would be able, eventually even in your own home, to be able to download the latest vaccine, which could totally prevent future pandemics.
But if you have the code for it, don't you also need the actual stuff, that this, the building blocks of life as well, besides just the code?
Well, the boxes that we're making, that we have the prototype of now, you'll simply add cartridges to that like you do your computer printer. Instead of having ink cartridges, you'll have chemical cartridges that have the four letters of the genetic code that gets put together in the right way depending on the signal that comes in.
So you're building that now?
We have the first prototype machine already. It's funded in part by DARPA and the rest by the synthetic genomics company that I'm the head of.
Well, that's incredible. In a world where we're worried about global pandemics, that's something a lot of people would be pretty interested in, I bet.
Well, if we can help get rid of future ones, we think that would be the first good practical application of this new technology.
What about using some of these new forms of life you're talking about, you know, for food? Is that something else you're looking at?
So we are trying to use this new set of tools for fuel, for food, for new medicines. And so for food, we're trying to code algae cells to produce very highly nutritious proteins and produce them about 10 times more efficiently than any current agriculture system can. So as we go from 7 billion to 10 billion people, we're going to need pretty dramatic new sources of food and fuel to not wipe out all the resources on the planet. So a lot of those advances we think will come from this exciting new field of synthetic life, synthetic biology.
Is it going to be necessary to have conversations a lot like the one we're having, but on a broader scale, with people who are just, you know, they're a little creeped out by this? Because what you're talking about here is not the natural way that we're used to creating life and building stuff.
Well, it's how life has actually been being built for the last 3.5 billion years. And we're just starting to understand that process now. And by understanding that, we can hopefully move it a lot faster. But yes, we consider, and I consider, that public education and having these conversations is an essential part of science. I think all scientists have the obligation, whether they have public money or private money, to explain what they're doing on a broad public scale, because if we don't bring the public along with us, it's going to make the next stages much harder, even if there's something that could be a life-saving technology. If people don't understand it, they'll react against it. And a recent survey has shown that over 50% of people don't realize that tomatoes and all other plants and animals are DNA-based organisms. And so if that's the level of understanding we have, it makes the conversations a lot more difficult, but show that they're much more important to have to make sure we're all speaking the same language.
Now, the technology you're talking about, and you're talking about, you know, for instance, sending the code for a vaccine around the world in a minute or even less time than that, how do you protect that? Because in the wrong hands, you can see that this would be something you might have to be pretty worried about.
Well, it is an important aspect of this, and we've spent a lot of time working on with ethical review and even security review on this technology. And the Sloan Foundation funded my institute along with MIT several years ago to look at the security and risk aspects of this. And, you know, it is something that is being constantly looked at. The conclusion was there are so many other ways including going to almost any farm in the country to get anthrax, that somebody wanting to do harm doesn't have to resort to try and design a new complicated synthetic organism, which takes a highly sophisticated science to even contemplate doing it, and I think it would be extremely hard to do. So, but, you know, the security aspects are very important to us, and the instruments that we're building will have multiple layers of security, so they can't even be used by people who are not authorized. So I think we're trying to think of as many aspects of this and working with government officials and others to ensure that what we see is orders of magnitude greater potential for good, but with any new technology, it always has the risk of abuse by individuals, so we're trying to minimize that risk.
We've only got about 30 seconds left for your answer here, but you know, you said you're less worried about playing God than you are about the possibility of not using this technology. Why is that your greater fear?
Well, when we look at how we're depleting the resources of this planet, changing our atmosphere, so we're changing our weather, as we're constantly increasing the population, we're going to increase the risk of new emerging infections and multiple social and economic problems if we don't have good sources, clean, renewable sources of food and fuel and medicines. I think our technology will be a part of the solution.
All right. Well, Dr. Venter, thank you so much for joining us today.
Nice talking with you.
We've been talking to J. Craig Venter. He sequenced the human genome and led the team that created the first synthetic cell. He's the author of the book, Life at the Speed of Light.